So what's the big deal with bushwalking? I mean, you go into the bush, there might be a track or there might not. You walk for a few minutes or a few hours or maybe a few days, and the longer you walk, the more stuff you have to bring. Water is probably a good thing to have. Maybe a tent for overnight. You get tired. Sometimes you get blisters. You might eat something you packed earlier. Then you lie down on the ground in a bag without a proper pillow. And you sleep badly. You don't have a shower, and then you walk back to where you started. I think that just about covers it. Melissa Harper, have I missed anything?
You don't make it sound very appealing, Michael.
I'm actually being silly because I quite enjoy it. But that is, of course, some of the ways people may perceive it. By the way, this is Dr. Melissa Harper. She's a senior lecturer in Australian Studies and Cultural History at the University of Queensland. And her 2007 book, The Ways of the Bushwalker on Foot in Australia, has just been updated and re-released. And I want to get to those updates in a moment, Melissa. But I might go bushwalking myself, but I'm not really a bushwalker, am I? Can you explain the difference to me?
Well, the way if you talk about just going bushwalking and you might do it in a casual way, as you've described it, it doesn't so much form part of your identity. So what I've discovered in looking at the history of bushwalking is that lots of us like to go for a walk in the bush, but we don't necessarily see walking as part of our identity. It's not something that we're really avid about. So being a bushwalker is for those people who took it incredibly seriously. And who did the things like who developed it as a craft. So who saw it as something highly skilled, know how to read a map, know how to go on an extended walk, to be self-sufficient, to carry all your own gear. So that really became what was defined in Australia as serious bushwalking, real bushwalking, in the 1920s.
And in being a serious bushwalker, Melissa, would that also encompass some skills like knowledge of, botanical items you see along the way, flora and fauna? Would you have an understanding of the stars? Are there sort of fringe skills that become acquired?
So not necessarily for all bushwalkers. I mean, I think the main thing that really defined them was that sort of ability to be able to find your own way and to be, self-sufficient, self-reliant. But for some, yes, I mean, botanical knowledge was important. Not so much didn't come across really people in terms of, knowing about the stars and how the planets align.
Right.
Yeah, botanical knowledge certainly, but also one of the sort of interesting things that I did find was often because the emphasis was on sort of, that skill and getting somewhere and being able to sort of complete that journey. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes people didn't necessarily slow down to observe the environment. That was often a point of tension in bushwalking clubs. Some people wanting their leaders or wanting others on the walks with them to take things a little bit more easily and to observe the environment.
I'm laughing because I can hear there's so many nuances to the terminology around bushwalking, because someone who may bushwalk doesn't necessarily go out for a stroll, and neither do you go for a ramble, because that implies a certain sort of blasé approach to speed. Whereas bushwalking, in the way you've just described it, sounds like there is a goal to be reached and we will reach it quickly.
Yes, often that was. Yeah, wanting to have that a sense of achievement, that sense of adventure, of reaching the end, or climbing the peak. So bagging peaks became quite a phenomenon as well. And so yes, that sense of achievement, the end destination, was something that many people, when they went bushwalking, wanted to achieve.
Melissa, where in the colonial journals after 1788 do we first see mention of people going for a walk in the bush for pleasure, perhaps taking some food and wine?
Well, 1788, Surgeon George Worgan writes about walking in the bush so very early on, and he takes, and finds pleasure in it. His companions aren't necessarily there for the pleasure, so they might be there more for botanical reasons or, looking for productive land, that sort of thing. But for him and for others like him, pleasure was very much a component of the journey. even though they weren't necessarily well equipped for the kind of walking that they were undertaking. And he laughs about that. You know, he talks about the environment, the bushes scratching him and ripping his clothing. But for him, that was sort of a source of amusement, not necessarily for his companions.
Right. Yes, I think there's so many attitudes as to why people take to the bush, and that one first account in your book typifies some of the differences in attitudes towards our wilderness, which then permeates other parts of the book as well. We have to make the point here, and you make it very strongly, that bushwalking as a pursuit was imported with European settlement and colonisation. And really, even today, you say that in terms of the waves of popularity that bushwalking is now experiencing across all parts of our community, it is still not particularly popular with people of Torres Strait Islander and Aboriginal descent, or particularly those people who wear English perhaps as a second language. Is that roughly correct still?
Yeah, that's roughly right. I mean, certainly surveys of its popularity over recent years have suggested that that's the case, that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders and, yeah, English, those for whom English is a second language, haven't necessarily taken to walking in the bush for pleasure. So for those of us, yes, a migrant background, often our bush can seem alienating, and the walking, because it often does require that sort of, heading into those sort of quite dense bushland areas, that can be often quite different to the environments that people might have come from, or just not used to that kind of experience. There has been some attempts with some organisations that have sought to assist refugees, for example, that have developed programs taking refugees on bushwalks as a way of kind of connecting with this country. So, there are attempts to try and alleviate some of that sense of alienation that might come from the environment.
Well, nevertheless, bushwalking has always had a loyal following, but between the world wars, it really took off. Tell us about that campaign around what was called the mystery trains in all states and territories.
Yeah, they're a fascinating phenomenon. So we're talking 1932. So we're in the midst of a depression. People are looking for cheap forms of entertainment. And bushwalking was really in its heyday at this time. And again, this was a phenomenon that was taking place in other parts of the world, but very much promoted by the railways as a way to improve their business. So they held these mystery hikes where you bought a cheap ticket for the train, you turned up to Central Station, you got on, you might have organised a group of friends to go with you. You didn't know where you were going. You were, taken on a short train trip, and then off you go. You were deposited somewhere in the bush on a track. it was not necessarily a narrow track that we might think of today as well. They're often country roads. You might have had someone like a radio DJs often were people that led these walks, or some other kind of personality. And you were led on this walk. It could be quite a distance. I mean, some of them were 16 kilometres, which is a pretty healthy distance to walk. Yeah, and in the middle of the day, there'd often be some entertainment. There might be a band. There might be people selling lollies and food. And then you'd make your way back to the, a different train station and be taken back to the city. And they attracted...
I was going to say, this attracted enormous amounts of people. We're talking about thousands in some cases.
Yes, in Sydney, one of these walks attracted 8,000 people. Several thousand people in some of the other cities where they took place. Sometimes they were more in the hundreds. So, yes, they were enormously popular and attracted, a lot of hostility as well from the churches, because they happened on a Sunday. They were very upset that the railways wanted to have a commercial activity on the Sunday, and people should be doing, far more sedate, quiet things at home, reading, etc. So there was furious debate in the newspapers about these mystery hikes.
My guest is Dr. Melissa Harper. She's a senior lecturer in Australian Studies and Cultural History at the University of Queensland. And she's the author of a beautiful book. It's so well written, called The Ways of the Bushwalker on Foot in Australia. And the reason we're talking to her today is because the book has been updated and re-released. It was first released in 2007. And Melissa, in the 13 years hence, so much has happened. There has been a revolution, you would have to say, in the way state governments and vested interests have been giving access to parts of our national and state parks for eco and cultural tourism. It really has been quite extraordinary. And there's so many different tensions around this. I'd like to explore that, because that forms a major part of the new writing for your book. Can you just explain the two sides that argue against each other as to why this is good for our bushwalking pursuit and why it's not?
Yeah, so it's been really interesting, Michael. So, I mean, there was a precedent for this in Tasmania, and with the cradle, the overland track, with commercial huts built along that track in the 1980s. But as you say, it's something that's really developed in the last decade or so. And the absolute sort of flag bearer here is the Three Capes track in Tasmania, which opened a few years ago. So what we have here is the development of, on the one hand, you've got the tracks and the huts that have been built at the Three Capes by the state government, which provide a level of comfort that we haven't seen before in national parks. So we might have some huts in some of our national parks, but not to the extent that, say, New Zealand does. And the huts on the Three Capes track that are, provided by national parks, they've got memory foam mattresses and cold running water toilets, etc., yoga mats. So there's that sort of development. But what's also happened alongside that has been the commercial development. So where you have a private walking company establishing even more upmarket huts and providing that ability where you don't have to carry much of your own gear. So that has, and it's been enormously successful for Tasmania. So that prompted the government to put out a call for more projects like this. So there's been money dedicated to a walk called the Philosopher's Tale in the west coast of Tasmania.
And but also other states and territories, Melissa, have really watched the Tasmanian model and have adopted that for their own. And New South Wales, Victoria, Queensland, not so much WA, but and South Australia to some degree, they've all learnt from the Tasmanian benefits of money rolling in.
They have, and that's they're really looking at this model. So you've got this tension between all kinds of people. Obviously there are some people who go, well, look, these provide the opportunity for those who don't want to have that experience of, that you described at the beginning of sort of sleeping out on cold, hard ground. So they make places that more accessible for more people. Where the sort of problems, I suppose, arise is particularly with that luxury high-end walking. I mean, they're very expensive. They're often $3,000-$4,000 for, 3-4-5-night walk. But often what they, and they're in national parks. So public land being made available to private interests for profit. Mm. So you've got that sort of tension running through it there really strongly.
And to make it even more complicated, but perhaps in a good way, is that there is more investment these days, whether it be private, state, or in fact Indigenous run, in cultural heritage, so that as you walk through these wilderness areas, you're also being informed in ways that you never would have been before about Indigenous relationships to country, land, flora and fauna.
Yes, that's right. And so, I mean, that's happening at the level with the sort of national parks ones and having far more Indigenous involvement, having rangers, having Indigenous input into the development of tracks. Mm. And as you say too, there are now, like in Tasmania, there is an Indigenous-run walk that's sort of, seeking to provide that kind of knowledge that we have never had before. And so there is, that's a sort of another, interesting aspect to this, the way in which walking is changing, that we are far more looking now at cultural heritage and history of places. And so that's, I think, a really positive development that's come from
this.
Well,
I mean, the arguments can go backwards and forwards between the zealots who love just getting away from literally everybody and exploring their wilderness by themselves to those people who are going for the first time because of these comforts and access. But all in all, the more we talk about it, the better that is. I think you have to say that's great for the future of bushwalking generally. And Melissa, it's been great to talk to you. Congratulations on the new features and the old features in this book of yours. It's been great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me, Michael.
Dr. Melissa Harper, author of The Ways of the Bushwalker on Foot in Australia. It's just been updated and re-released. You're with Life Matters here on ABC Radio National.